I found that if you compared being in a solitary confinement, or at least in isolation, relative, it was as bad relative to being a POW as being a POW as to being free. I just found it that much worse. It was just horrible.
And now when they accuse you of trying to escape, were you, or was that just an excuse they used?
No, I was being delusional, I'm sure. When I got there, I stole a, you know, we got to shave once a week, or I guess it was once a week, and they had razor blades out for us to, they had razors for us to shave with, and once in a while we'd get a new razor blade, and they weren't real careful about taking the old ones, so I just stole a couple of razor blades, and then I took them in my room, and I started cutting up one of my blankets with the idea that I would just, I needed a rope to get over the wall. The walls around Wallow were about, I don't know, 25 feet high, I guess, and on top of them they had broken glass embedded in cement, and then on top of that they had wires. And anyway, I was trying to figure out some way to get away, and the only way I could see was to have a rope. And I didn't have a plan made yet, but I said, well, I know I'm going to have a rope. So I just started cutting up one of my blankets. And then one day, you know, during the day, I would just hide my handiwork back in my... I forgot to mention we also had a mosquito net that we slept under. Each of us had a mosquito net. So at night under the mosquito net, I was pretty, you know, it's difficult for them to see me, so I was able to cut my blanket then. And then in the daytime, I would just wrap everything back up, and they were none the wiser, because they, until one day in early January, they said, well, they came in one day and said, wrap up everything, you're moving to another camp. And so we didn't think anything of it. We wrapped up everything, and all of our belongings, which, you know, it's just one handful, and went out the door, and lo and behold, it was an inspection, which they periodically did. This is the first one we'd witnessed, and it turned, well, when they found my blanket half cut up, they just went ballistic. And unfortunately, two of my roommates said they didn't know anything about it, and I told them right in front of them, you know, that I did it at night, so my roommates didn't know anything about it. But unfortunately, one guy said, yeah, he knew about it. So he and I got beat up pretty bad, and we both were put on bread and water for a month, and leg irons for a month, and blindfold for a month, and handcuffs behind our back for a month. So, and then we were thrown in these isolation cells back in what we call the Mint, which is a four little cells in one corner of Wallow. So that's basically why I got back there. They just really went, they were very upset with me. And until kind of strangely, you know, they want to know why I would want to escape. I mean, why didn't I like it there? And of course I told them, yeah, I missed my family. That wasn't a good enough excuse. Finally, I told them, well, I was a little concerned that the Chinese were going to invade, and I didn't mind them, but I was really thought the Chinese would be bad. And they seemed to understand that. I mean, they thought that was probably a rational answer. They didn't like the Chinese either, I think. So.
Now, do you have any information on POWs that were not returned, or maybe some that died in captivity?
A little bit. Not one guy I was living with when he got sick, and he never returned. A guy named John Fredericks. His body was eventually returned. He was a Marine gunny sergeant, but he was a backseater. in an F-4, and he got he caught some disease, scarlet fever, something like that, and at least that's what the Vietnamese told us. And then he was in, you know, my cell, or actually my little building, when this was up on the Chinese border. This is only about a year before we returned. And he caught something up there on the boy in the we were out in the jungle up there, and he caught something. But anyway, he got deathly ill, and they took him out, and we never saw him again. They told us later, or we learned later actually, that he had died from that, whatever it was, scarlet fever, I think it was. The only other, when we first moved up to this jungle camp, which we call Dog Patch, when we first moved into, in fact, is the room in which John Frederick was staying, although this little building we lived in had four rooms, two big rooms and two little rooms. The little room which he stayed, where he caught his scarlet fever, I had been living in, and when I first got there, and then I scratched on the wall, there was a name I've forgotten now, but exactly what it was, but it was an American army guy who had scratched his name and a little bit of his history since he'd been over there, but he had been there in 71, I think, in that camp, and this was 72. So, but I've forgotten his name, but it was in my debriefing somewhere. But I don't know, I never did learn what happened to him. And also in this same building, in one of the bigger rooms, actually, there were three big rooms. One of the middle big room was when they went in there. There was a big someone had scratched into the wall. Fuck life. You know? So obviously an American had been there, and probably might have been the same guy. But anyway, someone had been kept in that little building before we got there. But other than that, that's the only information I have about anyone.
Now, if you got sick, was there medical help available?
Well, there was a guy we call, a Vietnamese doctor we called Bones, who would, in fact, come around it once or maybe once a month to see if there were, this was when we were in Hanoi, if you had any ailments, like the guy, you know, he would come by. He came by a couple of times to see the guy whose all the skin had been torn off his feet and had put some, I don't know, sulfur powder or something like that on him to try to keep him from being infected. And if you had dysentery or diarrhea, sometimes he would give you a sulfur or a charcoal pill. And they also had, he would give you, if you're for any other thing, the only drug they had was a sulfur pill. So basically those were the two drugs, sulfur pills and charcoal pills. That was it, pretty much. I guess, you know, some of the guys who had broken bones, like John McCain, they took him to the hospital, I guess, and set it. There's a few other guys who had, I know one guy I lived with had a broken bone, and they actually put a rod in his bone at the hospital. So if you're really badly injured, I guess you got some, a little more medical care.
I see. Now, do you know of any escape attempts from prison?
I only know of two. There were a guy named from the zoo, there was a guy named Alpopi, who I never knew, and Mac, I forgot the other guy's name, Mac something, McKnight, George McKnight, no, McSwain. I guess his name was George McSwain. He and Appleby escaped from the zoo and were promptly captured. Well, within a few hours, they made it to the Red River, I think. And but they were recaptured, and then Appleby, I guess it's Apple. Forgot exactly his name, Apple something. But he was basically tortured to death, he was. I don't know. I guess his heart just gave out. I don't know what happened to him, but he was. Everyone says he was tortured to death, and there's a lot of people at the zoo tortured for that. They just had a hard time at the zoo there as a result of that escape attempt. Then the other guys who escaped was George. All these names are George McSwain and can't think of the other guy's name, but they basically had they were living at a little camp near the power plant in northern Hanoi, and we bombed the power plant one night and it knocked the doors off their cell, and they just walked out and jumped into the Red River. And George Coker and George McKnight, McSwain, I guess, were their two names. They got into the Red River and stayed all night, and they were floating down the river, and were seen by a fisherman the next day and recaptured. So they didn't get, I don't think, too badly beat up, because they were just, it was obviously not a pre-planned thing. They were really upset with the people at the zoo because I guess they still thought that was pre-planned. So the only other escape I'm aware of, I escaped the night I was captured on my way to Hanoi. We were riding along, and as I mentioned, I was blindfolded and my hands tied behind me. But this is after we'd gotten in the truck. They put me in the truck. I don't know, 5 minutes before they got in and started away. And this truck was basically covered in the back with canvas, but I was able to make a little hole in the back covering. It had these little snaps that you put in and turn to hold them, these little fasteners. And I was able to undo two of those fasteners in one corner of the back flap of the covering for the back of the truck. And I already knew I could get out of my ropes because they weren't paying much attention to me. I was basically holding them on my arms. And anyway, when they got in, we started off, and my plan in the back of my mind, I knew we were north of the Red River, and I knew the bridge had been blown down, so we had to cross by a ferry. So I thought maybe I could jump out when we're on the river and get away while we're on the river. Well, we were traveling along, and all of a sudden, there were three guards in the back, and two up front, and three at the back. And the guy beside me decided to check my ropes, and he saw they were loose, and he jumped up and started jabbering, and he was all excited. And I said, "Well, it's now or never." And so I just pushed him out of the way and jumped out the back and threw my hole that I'd made. And unfortunately, I guess, maybe fortunately and fortune too, I don't know, you know, I might have been killed if there's anything else. So as it turned out, I guess it's all right. But we were in the middle of a little village when this happened. So we weren't going very fast, which is good. So I didn't hurt myself too bad when I jumped out. And But anyway, I was still able to walk, and I got up and I started running toward. I knew I was headed east or west, so I knew Red River was south. So I started heading off to the south, and it was kind of a surreal experience. I was running through this village, but meeting all these people. So I basically just slowed down and started walking and greeting these people. And I guess they must have thought I was Russians or something, because most of them just nodded back. And then by this time, though, they had gotten the truck stopped, and they were people yelling and screaming, and gongs started going, and so I started running, and kids started chasing, and guns started firing, but I ran across this little pumpkin patch, oddly enough, and up on this little knoll, and there turned out to be the levee of the Red River, and so I jumped in the river, and eventually they lost me for a couple of hours. But they launched an armada of 1,000 fishing boats, I guess, and they were just all over, and eventually they found me. So I got recaptured, and from then on I was tied up very securely, I guess you would say.
Now, were there any repercussions from your attempt?
Well, not really. I guess they just considered it be a... they beat me. They beat the crap out of me when they first caught me. As they got me out of the river, and they were, they scared me a little bit too. I was in the water when they found me, and they started firing their guns from their hips or around my head. So, I didn't think they were trying to kill me, but it scared me a little bit. So I gave up, and then the guards got me back from whom I'd escaped, and they pounded me pretty, beat me up, because it made them mad. And then they tied me up like I were a mummy. I was a mummy. They just started with the bottom and just rolled me up from head to toe in rope. And that's the way I ride in Illinois. Mm.
So. Now, did you have any contact with the Russians other than the day you were captured, the two Russians that you met?
It was four Russians. No, I never... Actually, it was two groups of four. Actually, eight Russians total. No, I never saw any other foreigners other than that.
Now, while you were in camp, would you hear American jets flying and bombings going on?
Oh yeah, when the bombing was underway, it was every night. We, for the most part, it was night bombings. But when I was back in solitary confinement, they kept the lights on in our rooms 24 hours a day. We never got in the dark except during bombing runs, and so it is actually a little pleasant. They turned the lights off then, and so we could see what was going on a little bit outside. Yeah. But it was very exciting. You could see the shells or the AAA going up from all areas of the sky. And occasionally you'd hear Sam take off, and those were exciting nights when you had bombing raids.
Was there ever a bomb that landed close to one of the prisons?
Not that I was in, no. I don't. As I mentioned before, there was one landed close to the one that these guys got their door knocked off in.
Before we get into the release and homecoming, is there anything else you'd like to add about your the prison experience, sir?
I don't think so. I think that and what I've said and the questions I answered pretty much covered it.
Yes, sir. How are you doing? Do you need a break or anything, sir?
No, I'm okay.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Anyways, so tell me about your homecoming. What was that like for you and for the family?
Well, I found it to be a little bit unbelievable. I was afraid I would wake up. You know, I'd been through this so many times in my dreams that I was, and then, I mean, that was the most horrible dream I had in Vietnam. I dreamed I was home and everything was okay. I'd been released, and then all of a sudden I would realize that this was only a dream, and I'd start waking up when I started waking up. And I mean, it was horrible. You just basically relive capture, being captured every night of your life, every day, every morning of your life, you know, all over again. Because every night I was home in my dreams, and then when I wake up, I was back there. So it took me a long time to, I guess, not think it was all a dream. You know, it was just, even when I got released, when I got turned over to Americans and in the aircraft, taken off from Hanoi, I just still couldn't quite believe that it was happening. You know, and it took a long time to that I wouldn't wake up thinking I was, or actually started dreaming that I was there and then waking up there. And I mean, it took a long time to get my mind straightened away on all that. But, I finally came to accept it, I guess.
Now, how about for your wife and Brian?
Well, in many ways, I think it was harder for my wife than it was me. She had all the responsibilities of being a mom and dad for Brian, and all the responsibilities of taking care of everything else. So all I had to do was sit over there and worry about myself. So she had to worry about me and take care of everything else. So in many respects, it was worse, I think, for the wives than it was us. And you know, a lot of wives didn't hack it. They got divorces and got remarried or whatever, or they just took up with other people. But the homecoming, once we had it, you know, it was just, it didn't take long to kind of be back the way we were before I'd left.
And how were you treated by the military and the public, and did you wear your uniform in public?
Oh, yeah. We couldn't have been treated better. We were treated as, you know, like heroes. We were treated, they were never heard of any of this stuff that you hear about happening to other Vietnam veterans coming home and getting spat on and cursed at. That never happened to anyone, to my knowledge. I know it didn't happen to me. We couldn't have been treated better. So I always been very pleased with that.
And were there any changes that you noticed when you came back that you were maybe not ready for?
I think the biggest change I noticed that the country had, as far as porn was concerned, when I'd left in 67, you know, a Playboy magazine that showed a woman's breast was very risque. And when I come back, you know, the porn was freely available. That was a disappointment, and it's just hard to accept that our country had done that, and that's the only thing I can remember that I found to be a change that I hadn't expected, I guess.
Yes, sir. And after you came back, did you fly again?
Yeah, I flew. I initially went to VA 45 and kind of got re-qualified there, which is VA-45, I guess, maybe still is, the instrument rack. And then I went, after I left, I only stayed in VA-45 for about, I don't know, 9 months, waiting for PG school, basically. Then I went to PG school at University of North Carolina, and so I didn't fly there. But after I got my master's degree, I went to the Naval Academy to teach, and I transitioned to AEDO there and then I didn't, so I had one more flying billet after I made captain. I was selected as the CEO of the Navy Plant Representative Office, NAVPRO, they call it back then. I guess they call it something else now. But at LTV Corporation in Dallas, Texas. So that was a flying billet. You know, they weren't manufacturing A-7s anymore, but they were taking old A-7s and refurbishing them for the Air Force and for foreign sales. And so we had three pilots there, me and two other guys that basically accepted the aircraft for the government and delivered them to in a lot of cases we delivered them to the customer, either the Air Force, or in some cases we took them overseas to Portugal or Greece. So that was a flying billet, that's the last one I had.
What was the first flight back like at VA-45 after being released?
Well, I found it to be very, very, very easy. I didn't find it's kind of like falling off of riding a bicycle. You know, VA-45 was still flying A-4s, so as I recall, my first flight, I got in the front seat and took it off, and of course, so we had some ground school before we did that, but it was a two-seater, so we had a guy in the back seat who had a stick, so he could take over if need be, but it wasn't a big deal. I think 7 or 8 indoctrination flights, two-seater, and then I was on my own. In fact, I became started instructing students in the instrument rack. Hmm. So amazingly to me, it wasn't a big deal.
I see. And I know you've already answered a little bit of the fact that it was harder for your wife because she had to worry about you and raising Brian. Anything else you'd like to add in the department?
No, don't think so. I can think of.
And how was she informed that you'd gotten shot down? And did they know at that time whether you were a POW or MIA?
Fortunately, her folks were down there. Her folks live in North Carolina, lived in North Carolina at that time, and they were visiting her. And they just came home one afternoon, and there was a Navy car in the driveway, and Elise didn't think anything of it and then she saw it was the skipper's wife and a chaplain, and then of course she knew right away something had happened, and they told her, you know, that I gotten shot down, but they saw me running on the ground, so they thought I was okay. And so it was good news and bad news, and so, but that's how it happened.
Hmm. I see. And while you were in Vietnam, how did Brian grow up for the first 5 and a half, or really when he was 6 years old is when he came back? What were those years like, and did your wife keep a picture of you and kind of tell him a little bit about you as he was growing up?
Oh, yeah, she did that a lot, I think, and she would tell him a lot about me. And she, you know, there were a lot of women kind of in her situation here in Jacksonville, and some of them had children Brian's age. In fact, one of the guys off my ship was who was shot down in MIA. He had a wife, here, and he had a son. She had a son that was Brian's age, and so they became really good friends. And the squadron people helped also. They we had some good friends in the squadron, and they gave Elise and Brian a lot of support and did things with Brian. You know, they'd take him fishing and that kind of stuff, play ball with him. And then I had we have some family members who did all they could to, you know, for Brian, you know, take him camping and things like that. So he grew up pretty without a great deal of difficulty, even though I wasn't there.
And so when you came back, was it difficult to transition to the role of husband and father, or?
Oh, not at all. I think it took an hour or two, but after that, it was great. I mean, Brian and I hit it off immediately. We went. I remember the first day we went down to play ball in the schoolyard down the street, and so he was all excited, of course, and of course I was too, and so we got along great. He was a great kid, and it just wasn't hard. It just wasn't a big deal. A lot of guys I understand had. Or actually wives, I guess more than guys, had difficulty when they came home because the wives had gotten very independent and they were used to making the decisions and doing what they wanted to pretty much. And now all of a sudden their husband was back and he wanted to kind of do things the way they were before. Lisa and I really never had that big problem. She was ready to give up the lawnmower, she said. but we just never really had that problem.
And did you require any assistance from POW support or therapy group or anything like that?
No, I never. We first got back, all of us talked to a psychiatrist, and it was the strangest guy I've ever met, I think. Most abnormal guy I've ever met, but we didn't have any therapy groups at all. Just that one meeting with a psychiatrist.
Now, you'd mentioned some disabilities that you don't get reimbursed for. I was just wondering, are there any, and are there any long-term effects of just the physical abuse or the mental torture that you went through?
I don't know. I'm getting ready to get evaluated for that here in the near future. But I find sometimes I have a little difficulty concentrating or following through on things. I don't know if that's the thing. I do have a little bit of an eye problem, which I think comes from a bad case of conjunctivitis that I had in Vietnam. So I don't know. Have high blood pressure, some cholesterol problems, but I think most of those are just age related more than anything else. I don't have any, you know, anything that I can point at other than my eye, which they have pretty much decided. I've got glaucoma in it. They pretty much decided that's probably, since it's in only one eye, and that was the eye I had the bad conjunctivitis in, they think that might be related, but they're not even sure of that, so.
I see. And you'd mentioned that you'd brought back some souvenirs. I was just wondering what they were and whether you were able to bring some of the clothes or the utensils that were issued to you.
Yeah, I brought back my cup, my water cup, which I guess I didn't mention before, and I brought back a spoon and a pack of cigarettes and a set of shorts. I don't that I And that's pretty much it. I didn't bring back much.
I see. You know, going back to your questionnaire and questions 92 and 97.
Yeah. Let me look through that. Okay, 92, have those feelings changed since you left? If so, how and why? I said I feel that for the most part our effort were sacrificed or wasted. Well, I think I explained that pretty much in the number 117.
Yes, sir, you're right, you did.
That's what I was talking about in 92.
Okay, that we just didn't learn from the past, basically.
Right. Yeah, we learned for a short period and then we forgot it.
You're right, sir. Now your second son, how old is he now, sir?
He's 30.
I see. And did any of them serve in the military?
No, none of them.
I see. Anything else you'd like to add, sir?
Don't think so. I think you've asked practically everything I could think of, more than I could think of.
Yes, sir. And your response to question 117, I mean, I totally concur with that. You know, I'm a little disillusioned right now.
Yeah, I am too, but unfortunately, I guess that's somebody's. We can't both be right, I guess.
Right.
I don't know. I agree.
That's right, and I'm hoping that in the future maybe things will change.
I am too.
Yes, sir.
I don't think for 4 years though. Yeah, it will. Unfortunately.
Yes, sir. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. All right. Well, nice talking to you, and I wish you all the luck in the world with your paper. I hope everything works out well and with the rest of your Navy career.
Well, thank you very much, sir. Thank you for taking the time. I know this was much longer than I thought it was going to be, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this tape, and I will send this to Texas Tech, and they will type all this stuff up, and you will get a copy of that. And then they will add it to their website.
Okay, I still haven't sent you that form that I guess I need to send you, right?
The release form, yes, sir.
Yeah, I'll send that up to you too.
Yes, sir. And thank you for doing this interview. I think it's very important that just like the website's effort, I think it's very important for some of us youngsters to know about all the sacrifices that you all made, because I cannot imagine being in a prison for 5.5 years away from my family, away from what I know as a comfortable environment, and I mean it must have taken a lot, and my hat's off to you, sir.
Well, thank you very much, and good luck to you.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, bye-bye.
Take care, bye-bye.